The history of Rocky Horror is a history of cinema.
For everything you like about Rocky Horror, there was at least one film that inspired it.
And we're going to review them all on Episode Zero. Everybody, and welcome back to Episode Zero, the Rocky Horror Picture Show podcast, where we don't really talk about the Rocky Horror Picture Show. Yeah. My name is William Bibbiani. I am a critic. Everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. I, too, am a critic. I don't have a cool nickname.
And you never will.
No. I'm in my 40s now. It's way too late. Getting a nickname is a young man's game.
All right. Well, in any case, this is the podcast where Whitney and I, here at Episode Zero, we look at the prehistory of pop culture phenomena, the kinds of movies that everyone knows or at least has heard about and have just become an institution unto themselves to the extent that we sometimes take for granted that they came from a long tradition of cinema that preceded them. And we talk about the various films and whatnot that inspired those movies. We already talked about Star Wars, and we are about two-thirds of the way through our look back into the history of the Rocky Horror Picture Show, the cult midnight movie phenomenon, musical, queer cinema icon, comedy, one of the first bastions of like theater interactivity. Where people tried to turn motion pictures into an interactive stage experience in a consistent way.
One of the big six when it comes to midnight movies.
Okay, clearly you want me to ask.
Well,
what are the other five?
Can you name the other five?
Okay.
I'll name them really quickly.
No. Give me a second here. El Topo?
El Topo was the first.
Okay. The big six. What do we got here? El Topo. Reefer Madness?
Not quite.
Okay. On the wavelength, though.
Yeah. From 1971 to 1977, there was this explosion of like really important midnight movies. El Topo was the first one. That led to midnight revivals of Night of the Living Dead. That was the second one.
Oh, is that
one.
Considered?
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's considered a big one. One we don't really talk about too much anymore, but The Harder They Come was really, really huge.
Oh, yeah. That was a big fucking deal. Yeah.
There was the Rocky Horror Picture Show. Mm-hmm. There was Pink Flamingos.
Yes.
That was a huge midnight hit. And the last one that came out in 77 was Eraserhead.
Oh, okay. My other guess would have been The Wall.
That's a good guess, too.
Okay. Right. But you're
The Wall is amazing.
All those are big deals.
Yeah. And the Rocky Horror Picture Show is still sort of the crown jewel of midnight cinema to this day.
I bet there's a lot of Rocky Horror Picture Show fans who are just desperate to finally get back into a theater and enjoy the big screen.
I mean, Rocky Horror is, it's not just the movie, it's a community.
Exactly.
It's where a lot of people, a lot of people went because it was their only refuge. It used to be a place where a lot of queer kids could just be queer openly. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, maybe they were living in a little bit more of a repressive household and it was a bastion, it was a safe place for them. It was a place where you could just be kinky, you could be sexual, and it was a really important scene for a lot of people, and still is to this day.
And the Ashley's, yeah. I think it's a good segue, because we're talking about Rocky Horror as a phenomenon that wasn't just a motion picture phenomenon, but it was also, it was about creating a space.
Yeah.
Creating a space in which people could be a certain way, could just be themselves without having to worry about outsiders. And that is the fundamental premise of the movie we're talking about on this week's Episode Zero. We are talking about the 1939 star-studded George Cukor classic, The Women.
Edith, take a good grip on yourself. You're going to die. Stephen Haynes is stepping out on Mary.
But Sylvia, who told you? A manicurist?
What girl?
This Crystal Allen.
Crystal Allen?
Yes, you know, the girl who's hooked Mr. Haynes.
Hey, what happened to the hot date you had on for tonight, darling?
It's hotter than ever, dear. I'm having him dine at my place. About time he found out I was a home girl.
Home girl? Get her. Why don't you borrow the quintuplets for the evening?
Because I'm all the baby he wants, pet.
Now's your chance to go in there and put an end to this thing, Mary. Go in there and just say a few quiet words. Tell her you'll make Stephen's life an absolute tornado till he gives her up. Look where she was 6 months ago, and look where she is now.
Sylvia, will you please let me do what I want to with my own life?
You're very confident, aren't you?
Yes, because I know Stephen couldn't love a girl like you. Well, if he couldn't, he's an awfully good actor.
The women was pretty noteworthy at the time. For a couple of different reasons, but the biggest one is...
The 1939 film.
Yeah. And again, 1939 was a hell of a year for cinema. Mm-hmm. We just covered it recently a couple months ago on our podcast on Patreon, Only the Best. We review every single film ever nominated for Best Picture. We covered 1939. Mm-hmm. A mostly stunning year for cinema overall. And this wasn't even nominated for Best Picture.
No.
And I'm actually a little surprised. but it was a really competitive year, and I guess I kind of get it. But in 1939, this was a movie that had a cast of, like, dozens of recognizable people. Mm. And none of them were men. There is not one male character who shows up on screen in this movie. This is about women in spaces for women, talking, theoretically at least, in the way they would when men aren't around. That is the appeal of the movie. That is the appeal of the story. It's certainly an appeal for the cast. And it's still pretty novel. Mm-hmm. It's very, very rare for a movie to have an entirely female cast. Especially a cast this size.
And indeed... it's very pointed because the plot revolves around a cheating husband. Mm. And the husband is only ever on the other end of a telephone.
Mm.
And
or in the other room, maybe.
Yeah, maybe he's in the other room. But for the most part, he's absent. And what is interesting about the women is not only does it take place in women's spaces, like it opens in a spa, a women's spa, where they're all getting like beauty treatments or exercising. And, you know, places where men aren't allowed.
Mm-hmm. Like but women's dressing rooms or fashion shows, which theoretically men could join, but they weren't there in that one. And also women's bedrooms and,
A mother and daughter going on vacation, conversations between mothers and daughters. I think in telling the story absent of men, when it's a story about a man's infidelity, is essentially kind of Rosencrantz and Guildensterning it a bit, where... the male character would have his own movie. Mm. There's like a parallel movie going on here where he's having this.
He's played by Clark Gable or something, and it's a big fucking to do.
For some reason, I kept picturing him as Herbert Lom from the Pink Panther movies. That's how he looked in my head.
Okay.
He was too young to be in a movie in 1939, but that's what the husband character looked like in my head.
Mm-hmm.
There's a parallel movie here where we get to see his drama, and we get to see how.
I think you think of Charles Boyer, because Charles Boyer has a Herbert Lomish quality. I think.
It's like maybe so. Yeah.
A sexy Herbert Lom. This may be sacrilege to either Herbert Lom fans or Charles Boyer fans, but for me, I feel like that in your head, that's where you're going.
Herbert Lom is hilarious in those Pink Panther movies. He's a very talented actor. Wouldn't call him a sex symbol necessarily.
Charles Boyer was.
Charles Boyer certainly was. But yeah, we've seen the story where the fellow has like a torrid affair and he like finds new connection with somebody who's not his wife, and his wife has some sort of negative quality, and he has to sort of wrestle between.
Or it's about how that infidelity affects the wife. And in fact, we've actually seen this before in a film called The Divorcee in the early 1930s.
Also starring Norma Shearer.
Yeah, I just want to, real fast, before we get into the weeds with the storyline, I really want to talk about this cast, because this cast is fucking huge. We got Norma Shearer, we got Joan Crawford, we got Rosalind Russell, we got Paulette Goddard, we got Joan Fontaine before she was a big deal, we got Lucille Watson, Mary Boland, Florence Nash, Phyllis Pova, Ruth Hussey in a small role, Butterfly McQueen, I think, in her first role.
She was in Gone with the Wind the same year.
But I think this came first. And even Hedda Hopper.
As herself.
Hedda Hopper, if you don't know, she was one of the big gossip columnists in the golden age of Hollywood. And she was constantly getting the scoop and the dirt on who's having sex with who and who's mad at who and what kind of behind-the-scenes drama is going on. And, yeah, she also occasionally did little cameos. I'm sure it didn't hurt to keep her on her, on everyone's good side. But the cast goes on and on and on. Like, it's just this giant cast. All of the animals who appear in the movie, and there's quite a few, all of them are women.
Okay, wise choice.
The only exception to that is there is one scene, and we'll talk about it. There's a big fashion show in which there is a bull, like a picture of a bull. That's it. Even the pictures and the statues and things are all women. Very conscious choice.
I wrote a radio script. It's all female characters. Took place in a lesbian bar. And I, apart from a quote from Epicurus, there's no mention of maleness throughout.
Yeah.
I even tried to strike, like, hey guys from the language. I just wanted to make it as female as possible.
Well, and that's the ironic thing about the women, is that it's a story, it's written by women. It's written by Anita Loos and Jane Merlin, based on a play by Claire Booth Loos. Different spelling of Loos. It stars an entirely female cast. It is about the female experience. Not necessarily the universal female experience, but the experience of all these women. And there were female directors in Hollywood at the time. It was directed by George Cukor. By all accounts, apparently he was a wonderful director and everyone enjoyed working with him. But,
and he did make a good movie, but...
Yeah, but that's noteworthy. It's worth noticing. And I think it's interesting, and I didn't really notice this until I just looked up the trailer so I could put a little clip in. When the title comes up, The Women... They added a little subtitle in the trailer, and it's on the poster as well. It's all about men.
To assure the sexist audience that they could see it.
I'm so glad that we decided to make some room for the sexist audience. Because here's the thing with this movie.
Yeah, money's still green.
This movie opens with the rumor that Norma Shearer's husband is cheating on her. Yeah. Cheating on her with someone at a perfume counter. She's played by Joan Crawford. The rumor is started by someone at a nail salon who works at a nail salon, but it's spread by Rosalind Russell, who is amazing in this movie. She is so unbelievably over-the-top funny. Like, if she had played the Wicked Witch of the West with the exact same performance, it would be just as iconic. Be just as iconic. She's incredible. She's a really funny actor. This is around the same time she was doing His Girl Friday. About 10 years after this, she would star in Auntie Mame, which for me was my iconic Rosalind Russell performance. But now that I've seen this movie, this might be the winner.
Uh-huh.
And that's saying something, because I fucking love Auntie Mame. So it's about this rumor. It spreads. It starts tearing her marriage apart. This is a movie that is all about women, written all about women. And I don't think it passes the Bechdel test.
It doesn't. It actually does not. I was paying attention to that.
Yeah.
Every single scene, these women are talking about men. And this is why I compared it to Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead.
Yeah.
Because we're actually seeing the drama behind another drama. We're seeing... This is still the man's story, but what we're getting here
is
he's
the inciting incident, at least.
He's the inciting incident, but if we're thinking about, like, the movie that would have been made about the male character, this is what's going on when he's not paying attention. What kind of emotional toll are his actions actually playing on these characters?
Yeah. And I'm not saying that's not an interesting story, but it also feels a little besides the point.
Well, also, keep in mind, the Bechdel test was more about a certain kind of representation than it was about a bellwether for quality.
True. Real fast, because I don't think everybody knows what the Bechdel test is.
Alison Bechdel is a lesbian comics author. She did Fun Home, which was adapted into a musical that won a bunch of Tonys. She was... the author behind a strip called Dykes to Watch Out For. It's a very good strip. You should look that one out. But in one of the strips, two of the characters decided to come up with a gauge by which to look at movies and popular media.
And whether or not the movies are interested in the female experience.
Exactly. And so they Alison Bechdel's characters came up with these rules. One is it has to feature more than one female character. Step two, they had to have a conversation. They had to talk to each other. And step three, their conversation had to be about something other than a male character.
I think you left out a role. I think one of the important... And the rules have been sort of...
Oh, and they have to have names. That was another one.
They can't just be like woman number one in the script. They have to be multiple female characters. They have to have names. They have to have a scene where they talk to each other. and they can't be talking about men.
There was a really funny scene to this effect in Dummy, the film that was on Quibi, with Anna Kendrick, where she becomes friends with a talking sex doll. Look it up. It's bonkers. Mm. But there's a scene where they are trying to write a screenplay together that is very pro-feminist and can pass the Bechdel test. But while they're doing it, they're talking about her ex-boyfriend.
Mm-hmm.
And they start very openly talking about, wait a minute, we can't talk about this guy because we're not passing the Bechdel test. Oh, well, Christ. Oh, wait, can I say Christ? Does that count as talking about a man?
Yeah, good point.
They start talking about Jesus Christ, and they realize, wait a minute, that also makes us fail the Bechdel test.
Real fast, I looked it up to confirm. The two women have to have names was added later. It wasn't part of the original rules.
Oh, okay.
But I think for me, that's the one I tend to abide by, because it shows that the women were considered important characters in the narrative.
But the women do spend an awful large amount of time in this movie talking about men and the foibles of men and the men in their lives, and divorce is a big theme. So they're all talking about their ex-husbands and what they're going to do about their ex-husbands if they want to get back with their ex-husbands.
And unlike The Divorcee, which again, we talked about that one on a much earlier episode of Only the Best, because it was nominated for Best Picture in 1932.
Yeah. I think.
But it was right at the tail end of the pre-code era. And there were a lot of subjects that Hollywood was more free to tackle without having to, you know, really fall back on obvious moralizing.
Mm.
And by obvious, I mean very conservative moralizing. The Divorcee is about Norma Shearer plays a woman. She gets married. They get married quite young. He philanders.
Mm.
And so she decides to philander. But whereas he does it and everyone thinks it's not a big deal, when she does it, she's considered a fallen woman. Mm-hmm. And now the only people who will spend any time with her are people who are only interested in her because, hey, she has sex. So apparently it's not a big deal if we just have sex, and that's fine. And she actually ends up, for a while at least, going with it. Because why the hell not? This is the hand I've been dealt. This is what I'm going to do. She starts living that life, and eventually it falls back, and she decides she wants a commitment again, but
it's not super progressive, but it is for the early 30s. Mm-hmm. And
it's certainly not condescendingly moralizing, even though I think it has a bit of a tacked on ending.
It does confront that double standard though.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Here, as we find out that Steve did in fact cheat on her, and he is in fact having an affair with Joan Crawford. The issue of divorce comes up. Mm-hmm. Issue of divorce comes up a lot, and it's basically the whole last third of the movie. And at first I thought maybe it was going to end okay, and then we just started moving into production code land, where everything has to ultimately affirm the institution of marriage, and not just the institution of marriage. Every marriage people could possibly have is supposed to be a good one.
Yeah.
If you're married, it means you're supposed to be married and everything will turn out okay and you're not supposed to give up on it. And I'm like, I don't know, man. We'll talk a bit about some of the speeches that happen later in this movie, but there's a couple of speeches that are just about how you gave up on Steve. And I'm like, no, I think Steve gave up on you, dude.
Well, and there's a speech near the end where,
I say dude. It's dude. A terrible, terrible choice of
where
word.
Where the Norma Shearer character is she's given this really kind of tongue-lashing by another minor character that she just met.
Who it turns out is connected to Rosalind Russell's character in an unexpected way.
Oh, right. But what is essentially divorcee's camp.
Yeah. But basically...
They move to Reno, Nevada, which is evidently where in the late 30s, that's where you went when you got divorced.
Yeah, it was the cliche. In fact, Norma Shearer... So later on in the... I want to talk a little about some of the stuff that happens in the middle, but about halfway through the movie, Norma Shearer finally has it out with Joan Crawford. They wind up in the same department store, and it's a whole scandal. They confront each other. It's a whole thing. And she starts having it out with her husband. It seems like they just want to have a divorce.
Mm-hmm.
And so she winds up on a train to Reno, and it turns out the train is filled with nothing but women going to Reno, including, and with the exception of Joan Fontaine, who it turns out at the last possible second was having marital troubles.
Mm.
We weren't actually privy to most of those. She doesn't know him, so it's a sudden influx of new characters. And they're all living in, like, a trailer park in Reno for a couple of weeks while they're waiting for their divorces to be finalized. And they end up having, like, this cool cowboy enclave where everyone's cool. And then Rosalind Russell shows up, because even though everyone hates her, and she basically just, like, for the purpose of I'm bored and I want to stir up some shit, like, basically turned Norma Shearer's marriage troubles into public knowledge of front page scandal. Boy, was that a slow news day.
This was, you know, rich people around town were being reported by local, but yeah.
Still, it's the banner headline. It's a lot. It takes up more than one line. Like when war broke out, they just said war. They didn't give it two lines. Like, it's huge. So, anyway, it's really fascinating. Okay, so we got the... I just totally lost my train of thought, and it was really embarrassing. I'm going to leave it into the podcast, because that's human, isn't it? I want to talk about this fashion show.
Okay, the fashion show, it stung me to watch, because I got to project the women before I watched it for this. When you project a film, you're not really watching it. So I don't consider that I've seen it until I actually saw it today. But the print we got, it was on 16 millimeter film, and the fashion sequence was cut out, which evidently was pretty common at the time, because I think the fashion sequence is in color, whereas the rest of the film is in black and white. It was shot in beautiful Technicolor film, and it just punches you right in the eye. It's just a little bit of a colorful, dazzling intermission. Hmm. Nothing significant really happens during the fashion show in terms of, like, plot or character. But I think it might have been a little too, like, slightly more expensive to print on film or to keep that in a separate reel. It wasn't common to splice the two reels together, even though projectionists can do that. I don't see why not. There was a whole slew of prints that was going around that had the fashion show removed. And we got so many angry customers who came to see the women specifically for the dazzling color fashion show and were upset when it wasn't in the movie.
Well, apparently it was originally shot in black and white. Yeah. And then they decided to redo it in Technicolor using a process that actually the initial transition, it's gorgeous. Mm. It's a black and white movie. And then you see the stage, and all around the stage is still in black and white, but the stage is in color.
Yeah.
This is a complicated photographic process that they apparently developed for The Wizard of Oz, but they decided to go the more analog route. Mm. And just, Wizard of Oz works great. Same year, similar trickery. So it's all the women, they go to a department store, and they just show off all of the new fashion lines. Mm. The dresses in this movie were done by a designer named Adrian. Adrian is one of those fashion designers where if you watch a lot of old movies, there's a certain names you're going to notice in the credits over and over again. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean like, I guess that actor was in a bunch of things, wasn't he? Like, no, you're going to see Edith Head all over the place, and you're going to see Adrian all over the place. There are certain costume designers who just, even if they didn't do the full costume, you will see in the credit of a movie like, Claudette Colbert's dress is by Adrian.
Right.
Because they're the star. Adrian was a big fucking deal. And Adrian designed, like, apparently, like, hundreds of dresses for this movie. Mm. And this show is basically a love letter to Adrian, because it's just showing off everything Adrian's got in his little bag.
Yeah.
Some of the dresses in this sequence are really gorgeous. Some of them look ridiculous. Some of them have plastic, like, clear plastic visors on them. And I'm watching this and I'm like, I know I don't know a lot about fashion, but pretty sure that wasn't a thing. Hmm. Pretty sure that wasn't hip for a while. Adrian didn't nail it that time.
I'm looking at some of the fashions in old movies, like from the 1930s. And I'm always a little bit suspicious as to whether or not the costumes I'm seeing on the women specifically were popular fashions at the time or were invented for the film, because some of those things are bleeding absurd.
Yeah.
Especially when it comes to the hats.
Oh, well, big hats was a big deal.
Big hats was a big deal.
Hats were an enormous fucking deal. I've actually,
and men,
read up on that a little
bit. Yeah, men wore, just wore hats.
No, but I mean like fancy women's hats. And fancy women's hats. Fascinators. You know,
men and women all wore big complicated hats. And it seems to me like a lot of those costumes were movie costumes rather than high fashion.
Well, also high fashion isn't necessarily always designed for everyday wear.
Right.
A lot of it is conceptual. And it is designed to be sort of broken down into its base components to be transformed into everyday wear later on. Like those Paris fashion shows where people are wearing bizarre, out there outfits. No one's expecting us to walk around the street in those. That's basically there to show off, look what we can do with fashion.
Yeah.
And then, you look at, watch The Devil Wears Prada. Meryl Streep has a great monologue about how a big fashion line that might not seem like it has anything to do with you eventually filters down into Kmart.
Yeah.
And that's similar here, too. And people are making these big swings, and sometimes they're cool, sometimes they're not.
Mm.
And again, kudos to Adrian. I'm not mocking Adrian.
Mm.
Adrian and Edith Head, all these wonderful designers who did all of these things that I couldn't do if you put a gun to my head. Like, absolute total respect. And this whole Technicolor sequence is gorgeous.
Mm.
It's really fun to watch. And yet, none of the costumes in this Technicolor sequence are half as good as the costume Rosalind Russell wears in her third scene, which has three human eyes on it, and I don't know why.
It's like that Dali design sequence from, was it Notorious?
No, Spellbound.
Or Spellbound.
Yeah, Spellbound has the Dali sequence. Yeah, it's super fucking weird. So Rosalind Russell is, and again, I didn't know her in person, and oftentimes when you're watching someone on camera, how they come across physically depends a lot on who they're next to.
Mm.
Like, Tom Cruise can seem really tall. He's not really tall. But you put him next to shorter people and he can look that way.
I think he's 5'9". He's average height. But
I think he's a little shorter than that, but whatever. He's like, he's just not particularly tall. But you put him next to shorter actors and he will look tall. I'm not sure how lanky Rosalind Russell is, but they're playing it up.
Yeah.
And so she comes across as, like, significantly taller than other people. It helps that she's wearing big hats and outfits that accentuate, like, the length of her legs, not necessarily the sexuality, because that's not her character.
Right.
And she is a living cartoon. And apparently this was by design. Because Rosalind Russell's character, her whole thing is, she's a busybody who loves gossip. She loves drama. And she will happily destroy someone's life if it makes her day less boring.
Mm-hmm.
And Rosalind Russell, brilliant actor, was instructed by George Cukor to play it up as big as you can.
Mm.
Because, and I actually agree with this rationale, if she's too realistic, we'll simply hate her. Like, that's it. We'll just hate her. Mm. They didn't invent Neil LaBute yet, but it'll be like a Neil LaBute story. It'll just be disgusting.
Yeah.
Just a horrible sociopathic human being. I'm probably using that word wrong, and I apologize if I am. However, if she's a cartoon character, we can acknowledge that she's evil, but still have fun watching her. And she is just, the way, like, her hands she moves up her hands like they're claws, like she's a velociraptor, like a lot of the time. Like, she's just giving an incredible physical performance.
And she's the one who bites somebody later on.
Yeah,
so she's a literal velociraptor.
She literally bit another actor, and the rumor that I heard is that it left a scar.
Well, I hope that's true.
Apparently, that's something that made this movie kind of complicated for the studio. Again, studios in the golden age of Hollywood were monstrous to their performers. They owned them. Like, their contracts were ironclad. Their contracts were like, you cannot get married. Because we need people to think that you're available because we were going to sell you as a sex symbol. Bullshit.
Mm.
Absolute horrible bullshit. Read up on what happened. Read up on the many things. The many things that happened to Judy Garland in the studio system. That's just one example. And a lot of people just
watch the film Judy for like some dramatization of that.
Yeah, and that's mostly like looking back. Like, you actually look at some of the shit she went through. It's just harrowing. One of the things that studios would do is, if they're making a movie, they would play up like, these two sexy stars are going to be in the movie, and maybe they're having a romance off screen as well.
Hmm.
They couldn't really do that with the women. Or at the very least, they couldn't do it at the time because well, things were very conservative. So apparently one of the things they did was they tried to play up the idea that the many, many stars in the film were all feuding with each other.
Right.
Right. Which apparently was no more true than any other set. Just people got on each other's nerves.
Well, especially when you're living in that studio system and you are owned by a studio and you're constantly being told that you're a star, you're going to be feuding with other people who also think that they're stars.
Yeah, there's an ego thing. A lot of directors are in that as well. And
that's also common for just actors.
Well, the artists as well. Yeah. You know, it takes some people who go into the arts have an ego. Some people don't. And it's very, very tricky to navigate that realm. But if you have the talent, you might be able to do it. It's just very, very difficult. I've heard stories about the making of the women, but most of them were just the biggest ones were like kind of petty. I read a story where Norma Shearer had to, when they film a scene with two actors and both actors are on screen, it's really simple. When they film a screen with only one actor on camera, they'll often ask the other actor to be off camera and deliver their lines, the other half of the scene. Or if they're not available, sometimes they'll just have a script reader do it or the director.
Or a stand-in.
Or a stand-in, whatever. Apparently, when they were filming some of Norma Shearer's scenes with Joan Crawford, Joan Crawford, when she was off camera doing that bit, she was knitting really loud. Just clickety-clackety-clickety-clackety. It was pissing Norma Shearer off, and Joan Crawford ended up walking off in a huff.
Joan Crawford was knitting. Awful. It's just awful to everybody.
I have a lot of respect for Joan Crawford. As a performer, a lot of things in her real life were actually pretty shitty. But boy, what a fascinating human being! Say that.
Norma Shearer, my secret girlfriend. I'm fixated on Norma Shearer. She's not just a great actor. She's very natural.
Yeah.
You look at Joan Crawford, or even Rosalind Russell. They're clearly like putting on airs. They have affected performances, and I feel like Norma Shearer, going back even to the early 30s, had this very natural quality. She always seemed very comfortable.
She feels like a very modern actor.
Yeah.
Her Romeo and Juliet, she was miscast. It's not a good movie. But other than that, I've never seen a bad Norma Shearer performance.
Yeah.
She's always great.
And she's doing what she can with Romeo and Juliet. She clearly knows the material.
Yeah.
That's just a bad movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. And in all of the films I've seen her in, she always is completely natural, kind of has a glimmer to her.
Mm-hmm.
And not even that like movie star quality, kind of like a she's like looking through the screen and letting you know that she knows what she's doing.
She's got quote unquote it. She's got that it quality, that very natural on screen charisma.
That term, by the way, it's like if you have it or even the term it girl or it guy comes from a movie called It. Not the one about the killer clown. It's Clara Bow, silent romantic comedy from
1920-ish.
Early 20s. And and Clara Bow was a very famous silent film star. And she, the story of It is she plays a woman who, in order to protect a friend with an illegitimate child, pretends to be the child's mother, taking on the bad reputation. It's all very dated. Because of that movie, she became this gigantic star just because she had so much charm and charisma. She became the It Girl, and that's where the term comes from.
Yeah.
It comes from a film called It. Norma Shearer definitely has it. She's a huge star, and I find it very disappointing that she's not mentioned in the same breath with people like Joan Crawford or people like Betty Davis.
Well, Joan Crawford and Betty Davis, Norma Shearer quit acting in the early 40s.
Vaughn, I think that may be a big part of it.
I think so. I think she was a big star, and for a while, actually, I'm trying to think. I know she made some silent films. I'm trying to say, she'd been making movies since, 1920, starting in very, very tiny roles. Was a big hit in the silent era, and then made movies throughout the 30s. And then she only made three movies after The Women. And then that was it. And I don't know the whole story behind that. But, where's Norma Shearer and... not Norma Shearer. Where's Betty Davis and Joan Crawford, for example, in Rosalind Russell, kept making movies for decades. And people knew them throughout their whole lives.
Mm.
And again, this is before home video. This is before even TV was really a popular thing in the 1940s. Everyone didn't have a TV in 1942. So... Yeah, her star wasn't, kept as shiny for as long.
Yeah.
For as many people. Which is a shame, because she's fantastic.
She's fantastic, and look at the roles she gravitated to, for ignoring Juliet for the time being, but between this film, and especially the Divorcee, she is taking on these actually very sterling feminist roles, where these are women who are taking a lot of agency, addressing double standards in the way women are treated, and presented women as a little bit more sophisticated when it came to sexuality. They weren't fallen women, nor were they blushing virgins. This is just a little bit more of a realistic female character, and I think she can be held up as a feminist icon as a result of the some of the roles she chose.
They're saying you're a fan.
I'm a big fan. I'm a big, big fan of Noor Shir.
I'm a big fan of a lot of people in this movie, particularly Rosalind Russell. I've been a fan of Rosalind Russell since I saw Auntie Mame as a young kid. She's absolutely fucking perfect in that movie. She's obviously completely wonderful in His Girl Friday, which is considered a classic.
I would wonder if a character like Cruella De Vil was modeled after Rosalind Russell
in this film. I would not be surprised.
Like fashion-obsessed, vaguely villainous.
Maybe. Honestly, I would not be surprised at all. She's wonderful in this. Joan Fontaine is really wonderful in this. And this was just before she had her big, big, big breakout in Rebecca. And then would go on a year later to win the Academy Award for Best Actress for Suspicion. Joan Fontaine is a brilliant actor. She plays a young wife in this whose problems with her husband all stem from money. As in, he's not making any and she is. And that's leading to all of these issues with pride. She's absolutely wonderful. Everyone's just really, really fucking good in this movie. The issue that I have with this movie, and I was really with this movie for a while. Like, I initially was I love the idea of the movie and I love the cast and everything about it sounds really cool. I initially got off on maybe a sour note because right after the credits, because it's a big, big, big cast. They give all of the actors, not just their list, they don't just list their names in the opening credits like they often do. They gave everyone like a title card. Like, so here's Norma Shearer's face. And then here's the character she plays. But instead of just showing Norma Shearer's face, they would show an animal and then that animal would fade into Norma Shearer. And oftentimes they were cool things like a leopard. You know, and then occasionally it would be like a horse,
like a goat or something,
and it would like fade into like this character actor. And frankly, it's mildly insulting, if not outright insulting, half the time. And so I was just like, oh, I hope that's not the tone we're going for.
It's sort of cutesy, but luckily it feels condescending in the credits, but luckily the film isn't condescending.
I was worried initially, and then fortunately the film got off on this great start, and it's got a wonderful energy, and we're just following everyone through this spa, and there's a million characters in the first scene alone, and then Rosalind Russell starts taking hold of the plot and strangling it, and so fucking funny, and then Norma Shearer starts being this total heart of the tale, and I'm a little annoyed that this is a story about the women, but it's all about the men, but of course we're talking about a world in which there's like an intense patriarchal element that is inescapable.
And that the wild caprices of a man can have these gigantic ripples in all of the women in their lives.
So ultimately that's what the film is about. It's just not necessarily how it seems advertised unless you look at that log line. It's about men. Fuck off. But the thing that started rubbing me the wrong way, I was with this movie for so long. Was really into it. I thought it was funny, it was sweet, romantic.
Briefly taking you through the story, the off-screen male character has been having an affair with Joan Crawford. There's a lot of to-do as to whether or not Norma Shearer is going to stay with her husband. Ultimately choosing to divorce him. It's been too humiliating and there's nothing she can do to salvage this.
I really like the generational aspect where her mom says, you know, in my day we couldn't get divorced.
So we just gutted it out.
We just gutted it out and we ended up, eventually he'll get bored and he'll be with you. And Norma Shearer is like, well, I don't believe in that.
That's a horrible way to do things.
Yeah, but I appreciate that the conversation was had. And I thought that was a really, really intelligent way to have that conversation.
We fast forward, it's almost 2 years, it's like a year and a half, and it turns out that Joan Crawford has married this guy.
Yeah.
But she's also a villainess and has been having an affair with some, like, I think it's like a cowboy guy on the side.
Well, it turns out they meet a woman who's had like four divorces and she's really wealthy in Reno. And then she has started dating a guy and then marrying him who's like a cowboy. And she thought he'd have a great musical career ahead of him. So she's gotten him like a job on the radio singing, you know, country music. And now Joan Crawford is sleeping with that guy. Yeah. And she's having all of these illicit affairs with her own. And this is a big plot point. Her own private telephone line. No reason to have that unless you're having sex.
It's a private telephone line next to her bathtub.
And her bathtub is huge and comical, and it's got like a curtain she can hit down with like a button. Like, it's absurd.
This weird technological marvel.
Yeah. But basically the point boils down to is Steve is married to the wrong person and he's miserable.
Norma Shearer and off-screen guy's daughter overhears Joan Crawford on the phone, relays some information back to Norma Shearer, and so she uses that information to essentially enact sort of a comical revenge plot right at the end.
Yeah. And that's kind of the thing that started bugging me a bit. Because when we're in Reno and we're hearing a lot of different people talking about divorce, and Rosalind Russell shows up because it turns out that this other woman they were in Reno with was the one who was sleeping with her husband, and that's why she's getting a divorce. Everyone's miserable. There's a speech that one of the supporting characters gives to Norma Shearer that just pissed me off. Because the speech is all about how your husband,
You should be great. Is it the "you should be grateful" speech?
It's not that you should be grateful. Like, that's bad enough. But like, it's not just you should be grateful. It's your husband had an affair because he's weak, because he's a man. They're children. You have to be their wife, their mother, their lover, their friend, their confidant, their agent, their accountant. You would be everything for them. And if you're not, you're the one failing him. And this is your fault for not fighting for him. And a part of me is like, that is a really fucked up message. And at first I was thinking to myself,
well, I mean, it's not the message of the movie.
Exactly. Yeah. But, hang on. I'm getting there. I'm telling the narrative. I'm telling my reaction as the story went.
All right.
Okay. Think of this as a live tweet. All right. So I'm pissed off because this is a terrible message. And then she gets on the phone with him. And at first it seems like maybe she's like going to decide to reconcile, make this work. And then she finds out that since they got divorced, he's already married Joan Crawford. So we cut to a year or two later. And he's married to Joan Crawford. And by all rights, by everything we've heard, they're miserable. She is actually doing fine. She's got like this fancy apartment and all these great clothes and everyone loves her. She's great. And I'm actually like, okay, I'm kind of liking where this is going. And she hears through the grapevine through her daughter that, you know, Joan Crawford's cheating on Steve. And then it all becomes about, we have to rescue Steve from this horrible person. And then they do, in this big elaborate thing where everyone's running outside and humiliating Steve in public and then coming back in and tell everyone what they did, which is kind of hilarious and makes more sense on the stage, but whatever, it works. And then it ends with Norma Shearer after we've, you know, ended his marriage spectacularly. And we've sent Joan Crawford packing back to the perfume counter. Norma Shearer walks up to the camera with her arms open as if to say, I'm yours.
Yeah.
And there's something that kind of pissed me off about that, because I don't think it was about that. I don't think it should have been about that. I don't think it should have been about, like, getting Norma Shearer, you know?
The,
like,
last moment was really inauthentic.
It felt
like this sort of forced-in happy ending, when I think the more satisfying ending would have been, okay, she gets to humiliate Joan Crawford, who's a villain.
She's not as evil as Rosalind Russell, because at least she's in her character. Like, Rosalind Russell betrays people.
Yeah.
Joan Crawford doesn't betray anyone. She's just in it for herself.
Well, she does betray her husband. She's, you know...
Well, okay, later on, yes. Later on, yes. I apologize. You're right. You're more right than I am.
She is deserving of the comeuppance, is my point.
Some comeuppance, yes.
There's this kind of door-slamming thing, and it's about how there's a great line of dialogue, how she says, like, the jungle cat is back, and she, like, has her claws out. Norma Shearer says that. And so they have this big, like, final finale where they get to, using Hedda Hopper and all the other characters, sort of bring all the truth to light at exactly... exactly a right, calculated moment to humiliate everybody.
Who deserves it?
Who deserves it? And at the end of that, she should have, and she ends up saying, okay, and I'm back, and she walks off screen, and the male character is just standing off screen.
Yeah.
It's like the closest we ever get to him.
Yeah. The male character is the camera, basically.
Yeah. What should have happened is, I've done it. I've fixed everything. Your reputation is salvaged. I feel vindicated now. Also, fuck you.
Yeah.
That should have been the ending.
Exactly. And again, this is production code.
Yeah.
They weren't allowed to do that even if they wanted to. And I don't know the original play. Maybe the original play, this is exactly what happened in it. Mm. But it doesn't feel natural. It doesn't really feel like it's the theme. I appreciate that the movie presents ideas about womanhood and ideas about marriage that even at the time could have been considered antiquated because they're presented that way. There's like, this is a previous generation's mentality. This is a whole wide variety of women, mostly from the same walk of life, different social classes, but you know, there's only like one or two women of color in it, for example. That's par for the course in the era. It sucks, but it's what we got.
It was a racist time. It was a racist system. We're not going to see black people on screen.
Not a lot, no. And
Butterfly McQueen was in it.
Yeah.
And she's not even credited.
Oh, shit, she's not.
No,
she
didn't get a credit.
Yeah, she's good in it, though. Yeah. She's really good in her scenes. In any case, there is a lot of different characters. There are a lot of different characters. And a lot of them have different ideas about marriage and what it means to be a woman in a patriarchal society.
Yeah.
And they don't always agree. And I appreciate that the movie lets them have their moment. Sometimes I feel like the movie oversells certain speeches and certain moments in such a way that it suggests that this is what the movie really believes. And maybe it does. And if it does, that doesn't age well. And if it isn't, I think they oversold it. I think the ending feels inauthentic. I think it's a great way to put it. And that stinks. And it's important to remember when you're watching older movies that there are things that are just inherently stinky about them sometimes, either because of production code or because of racism or because of opportunities that weren't given out fairly or a million other reasons. But that doesn't mean the story is invalid. It doesn't mean that this isn't a fascinating motion picture filled with incredible performances and it's really funny. The ending left me a little cold, but up until then, I was mostly with it, except for like a couple of crappy speeches. This is a really, really good movie.
It's excellent. And that crappy speech you said that was really pissing you off.
Yeah.
I was a little uncomfortable because I too thought like maybe that was going to be the message the film was going to leave us with.
Yeah, exactly.
But as soon as she gives that speech, there's this big twist in the plot that undoes everything she says.
Like I said, yeah.
And yeah, proves her wrong. So that didn't bother me so much.
Yeah, but for a moment I was mad.
The ending I'm willing to forgive just because I was taken on this 2-hour and 20-minute ride beforehand that I loved a lot.
Yeah, and it doesn't ruin it.
And it doesn't ruin it. It's, you know? Yeah, it could have been a better ending. I really wish he'd just given the guy the finger and said, I did what I needed to do and I'm okay
even
now.
If she just like said goodbye to all the women and says I'm gonna go find Steve and left the room, that would have been less annoying. But this whole like hands up in this almost religious pose,
right,
presenting myself to the man, here I am, that just rubbed me the wrong way. It just doesn't feel
it feels inauthentic. It doesn't quite fit the rest of the movie, but it wasn't so bad that it wrecked the movie for me. It's just it's not an awful ending. It's just bad.
It's what keeps it from being perfect. Yeah, that kind of thing.
It's pretty damn perfect otherwise, though.
It's really good.
Did I mention I love Norma Shearer?
Did I mention I love Rosalind Russell?
Have I brought that up enough yet?
Rosalind Russell is iconic here. You're a bigger fan of Norma Shearer. She's really, really good, too. But Rosalind Russell gets the scene stealer roles. She is fucking hilarious. Like, absolute all-timer performance in this movie. Like, she's so damn funny. I loved every second she was on screen. How does this relate to the Rocky Horror Picture Show? Well, as we mentioned at the beginning, that the Rocky Horror Picture Show was a film that was on screen and off screen about spaces for people who would be considered outsiders, often sexually. So the
not that women are outsiders,
I'm talking about Rocky Horror.
Rocky Horror, but yeah, because of a lot of just sexist tropes in the 1930s in real life, women were considered like second class.
Yeah.
But 1939, women could have only only vote for shortly over a decade at that point.
I forget the exact year, but it was not long.
It was like only 15, 17 years prior.
There were still practices in place where men controlled women's finances, even, you know, which is absurd. You know, doctors would like see a woman and then tell the husband what was up before telling the, like, there's all kinds of fucked up shit. Like, it's a really shitty sexist patriarchal time. It still is, but it was more so. And so having a film that was entirely about women when they don't have to be who they would be around men who might be terrible. And we can just see how people are in a space where they can be comfortable, even if they're still being shitty, even if people are still villains, even if people are still unkind, even if people still disagree. It's a very different energy and a very different vibe. And I honestly, again, I look at that on a literal level with the Rocky Horror Picture Show, where all of a sudden, like, here are these, this would be like, Rocky Horror Picture Show is like if Steve suddenly showed up in The Women. Like, we're doing we're doing a stage production of The Women, and we're doing one where Steve shows up a third of the way through, and is like, oh, hi.
It's like if Godot shows up.
Actually showed up. And it's that contrast where all of a sudden, and the thing is that here, those people don't have the power. Conservative America was the mainstream culture. And men were the mainstream culture for a very, very long time. And arguably still are, much to our detriment. And I think that having a movie that is entirely about the space away from that is important. I think it's significant that the poster for The Women is viewed in magenta and it's a little Nell.
Columbia.
It's in magenta and Columbia's room where they are together, free from Frank, in a very different looking space. I don't think that's a coincidence. No. I think that's definitely on the nose.
And the Rocky Horror Picture Show is not not necessarily a women's film. It's more about the male characters generally. But it is also about the women's sexual liberation. I mean, think of Touch a Touch of Me with Janet, and the strange sapphic relationship that Magenta and Columbia seem to have. It's in there.
Strange in that the power dynamic's kind of fucked up. I mean, they can be sapphic is all they want. I mean, that's fine. It's just it feels like Columbia is not very well appreciated in that house.
No.
I always felt bad for Columbia. Even the first time I saw the movie, I'm like, oh, she seems nice. She's a good tap dancer.
Everybody dies in that movie, so it's
but do they ever really live?
Every Columbia dies. Not every Columbia really lives. Yeah, she gets shot by a riff at the end.
Right. But again, I think, you know, a lot of times in movies we're looking to expand our horizons and our perspectives. Mm. And I think Rocky Horror takes this to an extreme.
Mm.
But I think for the time, The Women does too.
Yeah.
And certainly there are certainly other pictures about women. There's certainly other pictures in which women get to have scenes with other women. But this level of exclusivity and this gigantic a cast is really distinct. And it's really exciting even now to watch it. And it just doesn't feel like other things. I highly recommend it. I have a few minor issues with it, but they don't ruin the movie. And again, it's mostly just it plays differently now than it would have at the time. Damn good film.
It's great. It's great. It's just great.
It's a damn good film is what it is.
What are we doing next week, William?
Well, Whitney Seibold, if you love ham-fisted moralizing...
and midnight movies. We mentioned this earlier.
And midnight movies. You're going to love the next film on our list. We're going to talk about the absolutely legendary film, Reefer Madness, which is a film about reefer and madness.
I've heard it said that it's really kind of ironic that the worst of the anti-drug propaganda movies tend to be the most entertaining when you watch them while on the drug that they're trying to talk you off of.
Indeed.
I wouldn't know. I haven't watched Reefer Madness High, or any movies High for that matter.
Mm-hmm.
But...
No, it's true.
It was popular.
I can tell you it's true.
It was popular to watch this movie while high. That was actually one of the big reasons midnight movies took off.
Yeah.
The theater owner who had the print of El Topo didn't know what to do with it. It wasn't making money. So he had it on after hours. And one of those rules about not smoking weed in the theater was just sort of skimmed over.
We're going to let that one slide.
They let it slid, and people were hotboxing an entire movie theater watching El Topo.
Yeah, this is back when you could smoke in a movie theater, too, normally.
Yeah, that's true.
And weed was forbidden.
And in that wave, back came Reefer Madness.
Reefer Madness is a very early scare film.
1936, I think.
Yeah, very, very early. Not sure about the year, but anyway. And it's about two young dorks. Like, absolute,
squares.
Like, the squarest of the squares. Like, just nothing but right angles everywhere you go. And they're two teens, and they're in extremely boring love. And then one of them ends up smoking reefer, and it turns them into a maniac! Because that will happen to you the second reefer moves into your apartment or house or neighborhood, if you don't touch it.
It's the worst thing
that's ever happened to humanity.
The instant marijuana enters your bloodstream, you become just this fiend.
Yeah.
Like a just wild, drunken sex fiend.
And or homicidal maniac. It depends on what day it is. It doesn't depend on the weed. The weed will destroy you and everything you care about. By the way, weed is legal in California now, so enjoy it while watching Reefer Madness.
It's legal most places now in the United States.
I know. I know there are a few exceptions. I can't promise that weed is legal wherever you are, but it's increasingly legal because it's really not that big a fucking deal. And it's that constant awareness of how not big a fucking deal it was, even at the time, that made Reefer Madness unintentionally hilarious. Mm. So it is widely available. I believe it's in public domain, which means that if you want to follow along, you might find a crappy copy of it. But it's short. Just watch it. It's hilarious. Sometimes they do fun photographic effects where like they'll make
they colorized it and made the
weed people smoke like purple just to make it seem extra stupid. Mm. But it's a treat. I've seen it a few times. It's not a good movie, but we need to talk about.
I've seen it on the big screen at midnight. It's in the public domain. You can get a riff tracks for it if you really want to.
And we need to talk about how this film affects. And we'll talk about how it connects to Rocky Horror on a literal level. In terms, again, we already talked a bit about scare films, but we'll talk a little bit about the portrayal of the characters within, and also about how audiences have become sort of active participants in certain kinds of films. And that is coming up next week on Episode Zero. Thank you, everybody, for listening to Episode Zero. We love this podcast, and we love sharing it with you. We would love to hear from you. If you want to write in, our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. We'd love to hear from you about anything we discussed in this episode, or anything at all, really. Mm-hmm. We might read your email on an upcoming episode of We've Got Mail. We also have a Twitter. We're on Twitter @CriticAcclaim. I am @WilliamDibiani.
I'm @WhitneySeibold.
We have a Patreon, patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork, where we have a lot of exclusive content, including podcasts about Star Trek, Batman, Disney, the Academy Awards. We do commentary tracks. There's a lot of stuff available over at our Patreon. And we want to give a very special thank you to all of our patrons, without whom this show and none of our other shows would exist. We just wouldn't be able to do it. Mm-hmm. And of course, head on over to Salt Cat Soap at our Etsy store, etsy.com. Look for Salt Cat Soap. We just dropped a whole bunch of new designs by M. Lapis da Silva. And some of them are really, 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 really cool. They're all really cool. But like some of the new ones are like totally awesome. I'm particularly fond of the birthday cake soap. Looks just like birthday cake, but it is a soap. And it was made for me by M. Lapis da Silva. It was my birthday cake for my birthday. It's really, really great, and I'm glad I get to share it with the world. So I hope you enjoy them. Thank you, everybody, once again. And until next time, I see you shiver. Mm-hmm.